Listen to it, friends, and welcome to The World Transformed. This program is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. At The World Transformed, we want to introduce you to what may be the greatest transformation of them all, the one that begins with considering and acting on the almost limitless possibilities that lie before us, and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does this amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil, how are you?
Well, I am super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
Man, feeling pretty strange, but other than that, pretty good, I guess.
this weird feeling, I don't know, somewhere in my bones. Well, we're doing the Power of Strange all week this week. Here we are, it's Election Eve 2016. Can't believe this presidential election's already over. Gosh, it seemed to go by really fast, didn't it?
Which of course is the joke, because it feels like it's been going on for about 10 years. But
it feels like that's all we've ever done is had a presidential election. It's like it'll be a kind of a relief to go back and do other things. But we're doing this kind of in honor of the release of Doctor Strange on Friday, this past Friday, and also just because we figured there'd be plenty of strange stuff to talk about. What with the election tomorrow, seemed like a good lineup of stuff to talk about. Speaking of Doctor Strange, have you seen it yet?
I have. And what do you think?
Well, I have not seen it yet. We're hoping to our wedding anniversary
is
on Friday. Just tell me the end. Yeah, give me the end real quick if you could.
Yeah. Okay. You want to go see it? It's
very good.
Yeah. If you're at all a fan of the Marvel Cinematic Universe movies, this goes in a different direction, but we've gone in different directions before, right? I mean, Guardians of the Galaxy was a change of pace. They do lots of different things within this movie universe, and this is a new thing, but it's really good, and it kind of fits right in. So,
see, that's encouraging, because what if, like me, you're getting kind of tired of the Marvel Cinematic Universe? If you look ahead and you go, oh, Lord, I don't think I'm up for all these other movies. This one's kind of a departure, right? That's what I understand.
Yeah, it is. It's very much something different. And you'll, I think you may like it. The thing I was kind of worried about is, well, you know, it's going to be, you know, just a CGI fest, and movies like that tend to be, they get old, you know.
Yeah.
The way they handle it, Phil, is very cool.
Visually, in the trailer, you see some similarities to Inception. Is it Inception like in any way, or is that just a kind of
Inception didn't pop into my head while I was watching it, but come think of it, yeah, there's definitely some Inception going on there. What did pop into my head is Escher.
Cool.
There's some Escher like things going on several times in the show. It's good. It is an origin movie, and a lot of people don't like origin superhero movies. You know, you spend half the movie showing how someone becomes what they are, right?
Yeah.
And sometimes that can that makes the story drag down or whatever. I thought they handled it very well. He has a particularly interesting origin story.
Right. Right. If and people are familiar with the comics, we'll know that. We won't
belabor that or spoil that for anybody.
Yeah,
but that's,
for those who don't know.
It's, you want to go see this, Phil. This is if you're, not going to every single one of the Marvel Cinematic Universe movies like I've been doing, and you just go to the ones that have good buzz and everything. This is one. I think it's about 85% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Ah,
so the critics like it. And I think, and as usual, the audience for movies like this is
99.98% or something, right?
Yeah, pretty much everybody that's not a critic, it's like almost 100%. Everybody liked it, so yeah, go.
All right, the Doctor Strange,
and,
excellent.
Yeah, you might be able to take. How old are your children now, Phil? What's the youngest?
7 and 5 and 5. So probably
there's
probably
some scariness in it. Maybe the 5-year-olds might have find that a little intense in places. Probably your 7-year-old can handle it.
Yeah, we're easing into PG-13. I think we're still doing G's mostly with these guys. So
maybe hold off a year or two.
Give it another year.
PG-13 rating usually means I can drop the F-bomb a couple of times.
Right.
I don't recall that they did this movie. I don't think they did.
And that's good, too. You know, because that can be skipped. We've heard it. So.
Yeah, been there, done that, you know. Come on. We saw Wolf of Wall Street. We're good for our lifetime.
Exactly. Yeah. We're full for life. Okay, so there it is. We've almost done a Monday Other Geek here talking about Dr. Strange. But, you know,
we kind of set it up. Since
We want to set the tone. Stephen Strange is our guiding spirit through this strange world that we live in. And we thought, Wednesday, day after the election, we'll probably have some more strange stuff to talk about. But we thought we'd set the stage here just by talking about some stuff we've been over a few times before, but just how truly and fundamentally weird the universe that we live in is. And I've got kind of an eclectic – we've come up with kind of an eclectic selection of reasons to think that's true. Some of them are like, you know, kind of fundamental weirdness, as I said, and some of them are just kind of unexpected principles of how the world works. And the first one is very much that the Pareto principle, which we've talked about a good deal of times and which we use to divide between the good news and the bad news on this show, is one of those just odd things. It's apparently built-in law of nature, or it's just the way things tend to work out, which tells us that about 80% of the effects generally come from about 20% of the causes. It's the 80-20 rule, that whatever else is going on in this world, you usually get – when you see something happening, that's usually caught – 80% of that is usually coming from about 20% of the things that are in motion. And it applies to so many different
things.
Well,
I guess it just simply comes down to some things have more impact than other things, and the way the math usually works out, it averages out to about 80-20. Right.
That's right. That's right. Okay. Yeah.
And, is there an example? Because it may be this principle might be a little hard to picture mentally. Do we have an example, perhaps?
The all-time most used example was always that like 80% of 20% of the people control 80% of the wealth. But these days you see statistics around that where you can keep breaking that one down, and it's like there's 0.01% that control 90% or something like that. So that one doesn't fit as well in the U.S. because that statistic gets bandied around so much and reprocessed. I think if you look globally, you would see that's about the case. Pareto actually he observed it around plants that he was growing. He had a garden and he was growing. I think they were peas. And he observed that he was getting 80% of his yield from about 20% of the plants that he grew. So it is a very universal kind of phenomenon. It's not just human behavior. It seems to pop up almost everywhere in nature. And it becomes a good strategy for life when you start looking at that. When you recognize, for example, that you will probably get the large majority of what you're trying to accomplish through about a fifth of what it is that you're doing, right?
There are days that you go into work and you feel like, well, today I don't know that I moved the ball down the field at all,
right?
Did I accomplish anything? Well, I guess with this principle, there are going to be some throwaway moments or days, maybe even.
If you average, let's say, the 5-day work week out, according to the Pareto principle, you're really getting it all done on Thursday every week, right, or something like that.
There's this one day that you're making everything happen to cover the entire week.
Yeah, it's covering 80% of the week.
Yeah, I can't argue too heavily against that. Seems like there's a productive day, or productive, if you put it together, there's probably a productive period of time spread over the course of the entire week that amounts to one day, right?
Yeah. And it is very much, it's a tendency, not a law. So it is something that can be worked around. I think, for example, the wealth distribution one, used to be argued
very strongly as a good demonstration of the Pareto principle. It's now one that you say, well, there can be exceptions. And if there can be exceptions, then you think, well, I could be this, you know, this completely productive machine, right? And I could get the results, you know, 80% of the time rather than 20% of the time. You know, where I actually learned it and learned to work with it was doing process management in the telecom business. It's a big guiding principle for those who analyze business processes and try to improve them. Right. If you start with the assumption that we're probably getting 80% of our results from 20% of what we do, and you say, well, if we can optimize that, right, and start getting 80% of our, you know, results with less effort. Or if you look at something like the 4-hour work week, right, that whole idea of, you know, you can massively.
The problem is that you might be if you were to cut your hours back in, then the productive time would go from one day to about 10 minutes, and
exactly.
Your income would fall accordingly, perhaps.
Yeah, well,
you have to be careful how you apply that, right?
If it applied in the 4-hour work week, you'd really be getting it all done in about 50 minutes, right? I mean, in the rest of those 4 hours. would whatever it is you're getting done in that week would just be wasted. So it's a good guiding principle, but let's talk about something much stranger, and that is the quantum nature of reality. And I've gone ahead and shared kind of the weirdest of the weird from quantum theory. Basically, what quantum theory tells us is that although at the macro level, in the world that, you know, that we occupy, the world that we live in of full-sized objects, things seem to happen in a very kind of discrete cause and effect. You're one place, and then you move to another place, or you're doing some one thing. That means you're not doing anything else, right? Quantum theory throws all that out the window, right? At the atomic level, at the submicroscopic level, it says things are in two places at once, right? It says that multiple things are happening at the same time. Multiple contradictory things are happening at the same time, and that what we get at the macro level is some kind of, you know, probability.
Yeah,
it emerges
sort of like the universe is undetermined at the lower levels, and what we get is almost like an averaging or something.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. We're experiencing some kind of average of, you know, a bunch of, you know, objects that are in multiple places at one time, things that are in multiple states at one time. I've listed here the wave particle duality. That's kind of the first lesson we all get on that one. Was introduced to me even back, you know, like in science class, and they didn't mention quantum theory at all. But this idea that light is somehow simultaneously a wave and a particle, and sometimes it acts like a wave, and sometimes it behaves like a particle. And I just shared on Facebook yesterday, there's this pushback on wave particle duality that some scientists are making. They're saying that there's actually a non-probabilistic way to account for all this. Highly contentious, highly controversial, but mainstream science tells us right now that you really have to look at it. You know, you can't decide one way or the other. If you say that light is a wave, you miss about half of what light does. If you say it's a particle, you miss the other half, right? So this central concept that we can't even really picture, you know, fundamental building blocks of reality, right? Because they're half the time they're one thing and half the time they're the other. Then the next
there's nothing really but math keeping this pencil on my table here. I'm looking at a pencil in front of me, right?
Yep.
If everything lined up to where the particles were all pushing in the upward direction, it'd take off towards my ceiling, right?
Yep.
And the reason that doesn't happen is there's just so many atoms within this pencil that if any happen to be pushing up, the math always averages out to where it's behaving like a normal pencil on my desk, right?
Right.
But you'd have to, like, you know, be a huge lottery of probabilities could, you know, shoot the pencil to the ceiling, but it's not likely.
But superposition tells us that it is up there too, right? Or that it was before you saw it.
There's some alternate universe where it actually happened, even as I was saying.
So. Yeah, and the show goes off on a weird tangent after that because it's like, oh, Phil, yeah, you know what? It was up there.
Well, Stephen is screaming right now. I'm going to continue the show over here. It would be you, but yeah.
The whole world just kind of, you know, unravels after that. It's like, everything
happens. That's right.
That one weird thing happens, and then it all falls apart. But yeah, the whole idea of superposition says exactly that. Until the observation is made, you know, each particle is fulfilling every possible trajectory that it can fulfill. And then when the observation is made, then it settles on one. You know, the dice are rolled, and the most probable answer emerges. But that is, you know, that is so different from what we actually experience. As you said, if you look around the room you're in,
nothing's behaving
objects.
Weirdly. Yeah, everything's doing what it's supposed to do, and it's because, you know, again, it's. I mean, if you roll a six sided dice a couple of times, it's possible you get a couple of sixes, right?
Yeah.
But if you roll that dice, you know, 10,000 times, then the likelihood is that each individual number is going to pop up 1/6 of the time. If
right.
you do, you know, if you roll the dice enough, it's very unlikely that you're going to have with a fair die anything other than 1/6 of the time for each number. When you roll the dice that many times, and that's what you're doing with all these objects. There's so many die rolls on particle trajectory that everything behaves normally as we see it. So.
It does, and nothing is spooky except for this one thing, which we don't observe, but scientists do observe, and that's non-locality. And that is this very interesting idea that it emerges from Bell's theorem, and it's this notion that there can be linkages between particles at objects at a great distance from each other. If a connection is made between two particles, if they're spinning the same way because they've been linked, you can take one of those particles and change its spin, you know, 10 light years away, right? And the one that that got left behind will also alter its spin at exactly the same time, right? That those two items are connected irrespective of space or time. Spooky action at a distance, I believe, is how it has famously been described. It's not something that we see again.
I think that was Einstein who said that. He didn't like it.
He didn't like that idea at all. He was uncomfortable with God throwing dice with the universe too. The probabilistic notion of quantum theory. But you know what? And obviously we're explaining them in words, and we're explaining them in thought pictures rather than in the math that truly underlies it. But that math explains the universe better than anybody else's math is the bottom line. The math that gives you non-local phenomena, superposition, the wave-particle duality, tells you how things work. I mean, it's the best description we have of how the universe is. It's just that it's fundamentally weird. So I think if you build from a fundamentally weird universe, even though it averages out to looking discrete, that weirdness is still sitting down there, right? And it's still emerging in any number of different ways. So I've included this other one, which is just kind of, you know, what we perceive about the universe. And I've got this, I forgot to put the link in, but it talks about the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, which I learned about in college, and apparently has fallen into some level of disfavor over the last couple of decades, although it's maybe making a bit of a comeback. But it's this notion from linguistics that says that basically our thoughts are determined by the language we speak. Okay, so in other words, our basic our basic structure of what we're able to encompass in the world depends on the words that we have in our head, right? Or the basic structure of reality that our language provides. There's really interesting research that was done on this back in the 60s and 70s. And to give a very basic example, people could not see differences in colors where their language didn't have a word for the color, right? So there are cultures where the word orange, for example, doesn't exist. That idea of orangeness doesn't exist. And if you showed them something orange, they would say red, right?
Or yellow, maybe.
Or they might say yellow, depending on the shade of orange you.
Maybe that explains the yellow truck company.
Could be, yeah.
I'm pretty
wonder
sure
what language they
the yellow truck company has an orange logo. But anyway,
exactly, yeah. So the idea is that if your brain is structured in such a way, you know, your thinking is structured in such a way that your language has defined, it's very hard to break out of that, right? You know, to get a new encompass a new color, for example, is almost impossible for somebody to do. It's like either you know that orange exists or you don't. There's been lots of criticism of this, and the weaker version of it, which is more nearly accepted these days, is just that it strongly influences how we're able to perceive reality, and that's probably more accurate than to say that it's absolutely determinative of how we perceive reality. But for those of you,
I probably subscribe to more to meme theory. You know, the differences in our culture can be explained more by the memes that each culture carries, more than the differences in language, because most languages allow for the expression of pretty much a universal expression. I mean, you can come up with ways to put it this way: if language were really a limiting factor, then it would be very, very difficult to translate documents from one language to another. And by and large, we, other than humor, which doesn't seem to translate all that well, we can pretty much translate anything we want, right? So,
yeah,
the differences in culture can probably be explained better with meme theory. But
well, you get these like that concept doesn't really translate. There's no word for it in your language. A lot of times,
yeah,
either we end up using a kludgy substitute, or we just, you know. Why do we say in English?
Well, in
English,
we just
like,
adopt the word. You know,
yeah,
foreign,
you know,
word
we say things
an English
like
word.
You know, it's kind of a laissez-faire attitude. It's a je ne sais quoi. It's the savoir-faire.
Yeah.
You know, it's like if another culture.
When something bad happens to somebody you dislike, you feel good about it, and that's Schadenfreude, right?
Yeah, it's Schadenfreude, exactly. It's like we just co-opt them. We make them part of our language. I think that's the
right.
That's the big answer to Saper Whorf is it's determinative to the extent that you're not actively engaged in these other cultures, right? That you're not letting
right.
them teach you, and you're not learning from them, and you're not kind of in dialogue with them. If cultures,
the best examples of the Saper Whorf hypothesis would probably be out in the middle of the woods cultures. I think what you were getting to, right, Phil? Uncontacted tribes.
Well, and I'll tell you another what one day will be a fantastic example will be when we're communicating with aliens, and this is why I want to give a plug to the movie The Arrival, which is opening this Friday, I believe, because this idea plays huge into the story. I won't say any more than that, but the idea that our language is fundamental to how we think, gets, at least in the original story, I haven't seen the movie yet, in the original story, that's a fundamental concept in what's going on in that.
It feels like, based on the trailers I've seen, Phil, that is central to this story. Translation, and the main character is a translator, right?
Translation is absolutely, it's what she's trying to do. But what incorporating a language into your head does to your thinking? Okay, that's I've said too much. I'm not going to say anything.
Okay.
But I'm going to leave it right there. But it's a profound idea, and it goes to the idea of you know, how are we filtering reality? And actually our language and the limitations that it puts on us could be one way of doing it. We did a show about this a while back, which is just this idea that from an evolutionary standpoint, even our senses are filtering reality for us. I've linked this story at Quantum Magazine. I believe this is the exact story that we did the show on a few months ago. But the big payoff line here is evolution has shaped us with perceptions that allow us to survive. But part of that involves hiding from us the stuff we don't need to know. And that's pretty much all of reality, whatever reality might be. And if you'll recall this, I don't have his name in front of me, but this evolutionary biologist who's touting this theory, he suggests that that you know the pieces, the conceptual pieces in our brains that make up reality are kind of like icons on a desktop in an operating system. You know, they have about as much reality as that. And it's like, well, you know, they're effective, and you can definitely make a working system out of them, but you're not actually getting at the real universe from them, which is, I guess, you know, looking at the election coming up tomorrow, I would say if I'm not actually seeing the real universe, there might be some comfort in that. What do you think, Stephen?
I love it, Bill. I love it. H.P. Lovecraft is his most famous quote, right? Most merciful thing in the world, I think, is that the inability of the human mind to correlate all its contents. We live in a placid island of ignorance in the midst of black seas of infinity, and it was not meant that we should voyage far.
Ah, so, what a cheerful guy that H.P. Lovecraft.
Yeah, that's sort of a downer way to end it. I'm sorry, Bill, but that was kind of his way of looking at the world, that it was too strange for us to take in, I think, is what he was thinking. So,
well, I'm gonna argue with him. I'm gonna say I think it is fundamentally strange, you know. And talk about Doctor Strange, right? He wrote worlds that Doctor Strange would be familiar with and would fit right into.
Right.
But even if the world is as strange as the Doctor Strange world, I think it is our destiny to play in it. You know, it's our destiny to see beyond what evolution has handed us, and to get to as close to the real reality as it's possible for beings like ourselves or our very different, very advanced descendants are able to get. But we got a long way to go. I think that's
yep. Absolutely. We're at the very beginning of this. So,
yeah, we're just starting to understand that we don't understand reality, which in itself is a huge awakening. And from here, you know, we can maybe start incorporating reality. And you know what that means is we're going to have to spend the rest of this week talking about strangeness and see if we can get any closer to reality.
Okay. Well, I will talk to you after the election, and regardless of the outcome, Phil, it's going to be strange. So I think we can safely say that it's a good topic for the entire week, regardless of the outcome.
All right, Stephen. Well, we'll be back on Wednesday for our amazingly strange show, and then we're going to do another strange show on Friday just to kind of wrap out this very strange week. Great talking with you, Stephen. Thanks everyone for being with us, and we will be back on Wednesday with an all new show. And until next time, live to see it.